Hey guys, welcome to episode number 38 of the Future Thinkers podcast. So today we're excited to have Jordan B. Peterson on the show. He's a Canadian clinical psychologist, he's a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, and he's also a political activist. So he recently came to fame after refusing to use an alternative gender pronoun. He's had fascinating lectures on psychology, and he's accumulated millions of views on YouTube. In this episode, we're going to talk about depth psychology, resilience, and many other things. I hope you guys enjoy this one. FYI, this episode is a two-parter, so if you want to hear the other half, go to community.futurethinkers.org, and the other episode will be up in about a week. Of course, before we get into the show, we've got to thank our recent donors and patrons, Todd, Alejandro, Zach, Ronald, and Bruce. You guys are awesome. Thanks for helping us make this show happen. Also, before we get into the show, Yuvi's going to say something about our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Eternity, which is a new blockchain platform that aims to solve several issues with current blockchains, like scalability, privacy, and transaction speed. So you might have heard about some scaling and transaction speed issues with Bitcoin recently. Eternity's technology is going to tackle those. They have several unique features that are going to make it ready for mainstream adoption from the beginning. One interesting thing that they're doing is that the tokens will be mineable on almost all devices, including smartphones. So they're one of the first blockchains to do that. Their technology has many broad use cases in finance, supply chain management, trade, insurance, information markets, gaming, and the Internet of Things. We met the team behind Eternity at the D10E Decentralization Conference recently, and we think they have not only technical ability, but also integrity. They're launching two rounds of token crowd sales in April and May 2017. The first one will be on April 3rd and will last for 3 days. The second one will start 45 days later and will last 3 weeks. And the price of the tokens will increase throughout the sale. So if you want to participate, you want to get in early. If you want to check out all the details about all the features and the structure of this crowd sale, you can go to futurethinkers.org/eternity. There are also several interview videos that we have filmed with them that are on that page, and the reasons why we're teaming up with Eternity in the first place. So go to futurethinkers.org/eternity to check that out. All right, let's get into this episode.
Welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova.
To get notified of new podcasts and videos, go to FutureThinkers.org and subscribe to our mailing list. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, give us a like or a review, share it with your friends, and consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/futurethinkers. If you're looking to get serious about meditation, check out the meditation app that we've created with Vinay Gupta called The Cutting Machinery. Go to cuttingmachinery.org/app.
Last but not least, if you want to get access to more content, hidden episodes, or if you just want to chat with us and previous guests, then check out our community at community.futurethinkers.org. How's it been since you kind of poked the hornet's nest in the last, I guess it was later last year?
Overwhelming. I mean, I certainly didn't expect the sort of response that I made those videos, which you may know about, three videos in, at the end of September, objecting to some legislation in Canada that is now being debated, by the way, by the Senate. It hasn't been completely passed at the federal level yet. And actually, the Conservative Party in Canada has started to rather vociferously oppose it. So that's very interesting. Another video was about my concerns about the Human Resources Department at the University of Toronto using these bloody implicit association tests and this diagnosis of unconscious bias to, you know, to determine that the whole structure was racist, and which is really, it's appalling as far as I'm concerned. And then another one describing politically correct game, you know, as a ideological algorithm, basically, that allows people to explain the whole world and feel morally superior. And well, the first two of those in particular caused quite a lot of furor. There was about 180 newspaper articles written about it by the middle of December, I guess. And then the YouTube response has been absolutely overwhelming. So what do I say about that? It's been very strange and it's still continuing.
Has it brought a lot of stress into your life?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm not complaining about it. It's brought a lot of opportunity into my life, I would say. Now, I've had to make a lot of adjustments because there have been a lot of different demands on my time. And it was, I was concerned from the perspective of being stressed for the first while, because it wasn't clear how the, what was going to happen to my position at the university. Now, what's happened is that I'm back teaching undergraduates. I always teach all my courses in this semester. So I was just teaching my graduate students and doing research last semester in between all this political furor. But the students have been very welcoming, so that's been great. And the university has, I guess we have a, I wouldn't call it a truce exactly, because that metaphor would imply that there was actually a battle. I mean, the people that I was dealing with at the university were by no means malevolent or ignorant people. I was dealing primarily with one of the deans. He's an older guy, and he was mostly, I would say, trying to make peace. He got a lot of pressure from the social justice types who are very good at organizing. You know, they're professional organizers and activists fundamentally at the faculty level, at the student level, even at the administrative level to some degree. And so they were claiming that I was causing an unsafe environment and all these, they're typical tricks, I would say. You know, mostly people in big organizations want to avoid trouble. You can't believe how much people want to avoid trouble, or at least they certainly want to be, they want to avoid being targeted as the perpetrator of trouble. You know, I've also had a tremendous number of opportunities because of this.
What do you think it is that is behind this sort of social justice warrior movement and the censorship and control of speech and all this?
Well, we've looked at that empirically. You know, this is material we should have had already out to be published, but that's been delayed because of what's happened. But we looked at the personality predictors of political belief in general quite extensively, and other labs have done this as well, especially with regards to liberalism and conservatism. So on the liberal-conservative dimension, on the liberal side, you have people who are high in big five trait openness, which is a creativity dimension. And so more liberal people tend to be more interested in ideas, and they tend to be more sensitive to aesthetics. And so they like to explore domains that are new, and they like to break down the distinctions between categories to see what happens. They're creative thinkers. They think in an associational way. And so on the liberal side, you have more of the artists and philosophers and poets and writers and actors and the artsy types, and also entrepreneurs. But they're also low in conscientiousness, especially orderliness. And so that means they're not very disgust sensitive to begin with. But they also don't care whether things are in their proper categories. They don't do a very good job at jobs like managerial jobs or administrative jobs, where you have to monitor and watch and keep track of things and organize and make sure things are done according to an algorithm. And the conservatives are the opposite of that. They don't get much of a kick out of breaking down the distinctions between things, because they're not very interested in new ideas. They like the tried and the true, and they also tend to be very orderly. That accounts for the difference between liberals and conservatives. So liberals want to break down borders and conservatives want to maintain them. And that seems to me to be the fundamental political distinction: borders between things. And that can be countries or towns or people or sexual orientations or categories. It goes across every level of cognitive conceptualization. But the politically correct types, they're different. They tend to be fairly high in openness like the liberals, but they're also high in another trait called agreeableness. And I think agreeableness is basically the maternal dimension. And so the PC types tend to see the world as victimized children and predators. And if you're a victimized child, then the agreeable empathy and the maternal compassion is directed strongly towards you. But if you're in the predator category, you better look the hell out. And we also know that the more authoritarian politically correct types, so those are the ones who are really interested in linguistic control and censorship, they tend to be less intelligent, technically speaking, and they also are high in orderliness like the conservatives. So the authoritarian PC types are a very strange hybrid of the orderliness that is associated with the controlling part of conservatism and the agreeableness that's part of maternal compassion. Compassion sounds strange in some sense, because the SJWs can be quite aggressive towards those that they put in the category of enemy. But I still think that's best conceptualized as part of an essentially maternal response. And we also know they're far more likely to be female.
Interesting you say this about the borders, because it seems like people pay so much more attention to what's happening in within their little social dynamic, their group, without paying attention. You know, if we're talking about women's rights, these SJWs are completely ignoring what's happening in the Middle East to women's rights?
Well, that's a different issue, I think. That's a really interesting issue because, you know, it's never easy to understand exactly what people are up to, even yourself, right? Because people are full of mixed motivations. But it's in the paradoxes that people embrace that you can often see their true motivations. And the fact that the social justice warrior types, the PC types, ally themselves or refuse to criticize the practices in countries, say, like Saudi Arabia or any of the countries in that part of the world that extremely limit the rights of women and the rights of religious minorities of all sorts. But I think the reason they do that is because underneath a fair bit of the radical leftist dynamic isn't care for oppressed groups. It's desire to tear down the current power structure at every level. That's a postmodernist trope, right? Because they consider the current culture nothing but an oppressive patriarchy. And so if the current culture is an oppressive patriarchy, everything that opposes that culture is a friend. And so in their support for or refusal to criticize, say, places like Saudi Arabia, you see their true motivation. It's not the elevation of the status of women, for example, because if that was your true aim, you'd be protesting about Saudi Arabia nonstop. And like this, I just can't understand at all. Like, why women as a political force in the United States in particular just don't demand that the U.S. stops treating the Saudis like an ally. It's like, what the hell? How are they an ally? They basically enslave their women. It's like, oh, well, that's okay. They're still an ally. It's like, well, no, actually, all logic would force you in the direction of assuming that that actually constitutes quite a major problem. But you don't see any of that. And I think it's the old idea, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That makes so much sense the way you put it. And it explains why there's so much fragmentation in these kind of subcultures and subgroups and how they turn on each other so quickly. Because, you know, once being gay became kind of normal in the West, then they're subcategorizing it into, well, then there's also trans, and then there's also, you know, the other kinfolk or whatever, these other subgroups. And once something is mainstream, then it becomes the status quo, and that's the oppressor. That's the new oppressor.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, that's also to some degree why these sorts of arguments will never stop. Because if you're playing the oppressor versus oppressed game, all you have to do is continually fragment the oppressed group, and you'll always find someone else who's oppressed. My sense is that, you see, that's actually why the West evolved the concept of individualism, is because if you fragment the group far enough in terms of oppressed categories, you end up at the level of the individual. And so then you say, well, yes, individuals should be given due consideration. Well, yeah, that solves the fragmentation problem because it's the place where fragmentation has to stop. So the left, you know, you can see this too with the continual growth of the LGBT acronym set. It'll expand indefinitely because you can continue to fragment the oppressed groups. There's no end to it. Well, the individual is the end. Ideological systems get devoured by their own internal contradictions, even if they don't believe in internal contradictions. And the fight now that's emerging between the more classical feminists and the trans activist community is a really good example of that, because the trans activist community has managed to redefine female as a whim. It's just something you can do. I can be female anytime I want. Well, that doesn't work out so well with regards to the philosophy of people who've claimed that women as biological entities have certain concerns that need to be addressed politically. So, well, that's a problem. So
that's why they're about to lose abortion rights in the States. Hopefully not, but it's a real danger.
Yeah, you can't make the oppressed into a homogenous group. It just doesn't work out because they're not. Meanwhile, partly because everyone is oppressed to some degree or other by the demand for adherence to normative standards, which are necessary. That's the price you pay for social being. There's no escape from it. But it's still the case that every individual has both a sociological and a historical claim to being oppressed and also the same claim as individuals. It isn't to say that some people are worse off than others, because of course they are.
Yeah, it seems like no one's actually observing the statistical relevance of whether we have to adopt these new gender pronouns into our language. Is it that necessary that we be talking about all the different subgroups as a new normal in the language?
Well, I think that's another part of the attempt to break down the patriarchal structure, roughly speaking, is, you know, I talked to a school teacher yesterday from British Columbia, and they had been told to stop using the terms boys and girls and also the terms mothers and fathers.
Wow.
I know. I mean, it's absolutely, but really, they're being forbidden to do that. So that's part of an all-out assault on normative standards, I would say. Because the postmodernists basically say, it's such a crazy philosophy. The postmodernists, they have a point, eh? Because they basically say that as soon as you construct a hierarchy of value and say that one thing is more important than another, then you automatically marginalize and exclude people using that categorical scheme, which is to say that if you organize a game, some people win and some people lose. Now, what they fail to take into account is that there isn't a single hierarchy of value in a complex society. There's lots of games, and just because you win some things doesn't mean you win everything, and because you lose one thing doesn't mean you lose everything. There's lots of games to play. So they just don't take that into account at all. Another thing they don't take into account, and this is the real deathly error in postmodernism, is that unless you have a hierarchy of value so that one thing is more important than another, you don't have anything to do, because everything that you do, really, literally everything, even the way you point your eyes, is predicated on your assumption that one thing is more important than another. And technically, it's the construction of that value hierarchy and the differentiation of things into less value and more valuable that gives your life meaning, because you're oriented towards things of higher value. Always, like, the reason that our eyes are making contact at the moment is because we're making the presumption that the emotional information that we're exchanging is of value. And you can't even organize your perceptions without a value hierarchy. And the postmodernists say, well, with every value hierarchy comes exclusion. It's like, yeah, but without any value hierarchies, there's no positive meaning in life. And they never address that problem at all. What happens instead is that they revert to their Marxism and say, well, we can't have a value hierarchy within postmodernism because it's exclusionary. But without a value hierarchy, we don't know what to do. So then we'll just revert to Marxism and, you know, this neo-Marxism, and divide people into their identity groups, and we'll call that meaningful. It's an appalling philosophy, and it's really hard on people.
Is Marxism this seeming final resolution to this type of ideology? Like, is that where this results?
Well, it's postmodernism nested inside Marxism. So what happens is the postmodernists, they basically make the claims that I just described. Also, you can see the postmodernist influence in the way that social justice warriors act on campuses, because postmodernists don't believe in logic. They believe that logic is a tool that the oppressive patriarchy uses to justify its own claims to power. No, this is exactly what they think. And it's really important to understand this. They don't believe in dialogue, because dialogue is predicated on the exchange of logic. And so there's no speaking between different power groups. That's why they don't allow speakers who don't agree with them to come and talk. They don't want to talk to them. They don't believe in talking. They don't believe in dialogue. They believe that the world is made out of competing power groups who have nothing to say to one another. It's just power struggle.
Wow.
Yeah, well, okay. So Derrida, who's the king of the jesters, he's the king of the postmodernists, he described Western civilization as phallogocentric. And phallus, well, that's obvious. That's the male-dominated element. Logos, that's the root of logic, but it's also the term that's used to describe in Christian theology. It's the term that's used to describe the word that God used at the beginning of time to transform chaos into order. And it's also embodied in the figure of Christ. And Derrida was a very brilliant man. It's like not like he didn't know these things. So phallogocentric means male logic dominated. That's what it means. Although logic, the logos, is a broader term than logic, but we can leave it at that. They criticize all of that. So there's no dialogue with postmodernists. That's not how they look at the world. So when they don't want to have a debate, when they don't want to discuss, when they want to block other speakers, when they do their no platforming, when they protest against people coming to campus to speak. It's in perfect keeping with their philosophy. And then outside of that, so the postmodernists were all Marxists before they became postmodernists, but it became intellectually untenable, really, to be a radical left-leaning communist slash Marxist by the end of the 1960s, because the data coming out of the Soviet Union and China about what happened when those systems were implemented was so appalling that even people like Jean-Paul Sartre, who was a fervid supporter of the communists, although never a communist card carrier, he even renounced communism by 1968. And so then the postmodernists came along and said, okay, we're not going to play an economic game anymore. It's not going to be the working class versus the bourgeoisie. We won't talk about economics. We'll talk about power, which is, it's the same old wolf in new sheep's clothing. And we'll make it the oppressor against the oppressed instead of the rich against the poor. Just all they did was take all of their bloody presuppositions, transform the terminology, shift it a little bit to a new linguistic area, and keep on playing their same old tricks. So here we are, 30 years later, and they've been pushing radical activism for 30 years, and people who've been trained in that capacity have increasingly infiltrated every level of organization. And that's also part of something that was planned. That's part of the long march through the institutions. So here we are.
That seems to be a common line, that young people get carried away with these ideologies, with these utopian visions, without understanding what actually happens if you implement the utopian vision. And that's something you've talked about before also.
Well, it's very strange. One of the things that was mysterious to me for years is I talk about what happened in the Soviet Union in my personality class, psychology personality class, because I regard Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who wrote extensively about this, as an existentialist. And I cover existentialism in my class. And so I'm prone to use the best exponents of a given line of thinking as exemplars for teaching purposes. And so I've been talking to my students about the Gulag Archipelago and the forced labor camps in the Soviet Union for a very long time. But one of the things that was very interesting is none of my students had ever heard about it. Well, I shouldn't say that. There was the odd kid, obviously. But most of the time, the first time anybody hears about this is in my class. I think, well, what the hell? People know about World War II and they know about the Holocaust. Why in the world don't they know about what happened in the Soviet Union? And the answer is they were never taught it. The question is, why not? And I think that Western intellectuals have never admitted their complicity in the Soviet catastrophe. And so they just hide the history. It was the most relevant thing that happened in the 20th century, I would say. You know, the ideological war between the West and the Soviet Union, that was, World War II was like a sideshow in some sense compared to that.
Yeah, how many people Stalin killed, it's just insane.
It's unbelievable. And Lenin started it. I mean,
yeah.
You know, because for a while, the excuse of the Western leftists was, oh, well, Stalin corrupted Lenin's grand vision. But Lenin had set the murderous path in motion well before he perished. And Stalin was just his greatest monster. And the same thing happened with the Maoists, you know, and they were worshipped by the leftists in the 1960s. And Mao's little red book, people used to carry that around it, you know, as a fashion accessory. And so it is a real question why our children have no knowledge whatsoever of this massively important element of the 20th century. But it's not a question, because increasingly the elementary school system, junior high and high school, is completely dominated by social justice warriors. And one of the most corrupt disciplines, and there's plenty of corrupt disciplines at the university, but I would say social work and education fight it out for most corrupt discipline. Well, that and women's studies, you know, that whole ethnic women's studies thing, which is just a complete bloody catastrophe. It's nothing but a cult. Like, the universities in many ways have turned into cults. It's crazy. They do the university students such an injustice. They really are cults. The only thing that's different is with a cult, there's a central leader.
What do you think this whole safe space movement has come from? Why are people so protectionist of, you know, of being offended or being hurt by facts?
Words.
Well, okay, that's a good one. There's a psychological answer to that, I think. There's a political answer, a psychological answer, and a demographic answer. And I think we should start with the demographic answer. As you might ask, well, what's different about kids today? Well, you can't say narcissism, because it's not like the baby boomers weren't narcissistic. I mean, good God. So, you know, that was the me generation. That was their pejorative label. And there was good reason for that. So, but I think one of the big differences is that demographic shift in the way we structure our families. You know, two generations ago or three generations ago, there were still lots of kids in most families. And when you're the third kid among four, that's very different than being the first kid among one. You know, you're a lot less special if you have siblings. And the more siblings you have, the less special you are. And then you add to that the fact that people are having their children later in life. It makes them much more prone to spend resources on them and much more cautious. Because if you're 20 and you have three kids, I mean, you're still half a party animal. You know, you're not that much older than your kids either. You still kind of remember what it's like to be a kid. And so that carelessness and self-centeredness, let's say, that is part and parcel of being young is actually a facilitator of independence in children. And then if you have multiple children, they kind of raise each other. And with some roughness, like your siblings, if you are narcissistic, your siblings are going to pound you flat continually. So I think that's part of it. I think that it's smaller families to older parents. And so they're much more sheltered and attended to and special. So that's the demographic issue. And the psychological issue is that I think we have a lot of students in university who have mental health problems, depression and anxiety. The rate of that has increased as the number of students enrolled have been female has increased, because women are much more prone to depression and anxiety, to negative emotion disorders. Men are more prone to antisocial behavior and alcoholism. They have their, and learning disabilities. They have their own canonical set of pathologies, let's say. But there's a substantial number of students at universities who are very anxiety sensitive and overwhelmed with negative emotion. And some of them have also been traumatized. And so they're the ones that are pushing the safe space thing. It's a personality disorder manifestation fundamentally. Because the real rule is, look, if you can't handle reading an upsetting book, you're not ready for university. The fact that you need a safe space actually is indicative of the fact that you could use some counseling. If you have a problem, the question always is, who has the problem, you or everybody else? Well, your first bet should be you. But if you're a little on the narcissistic side and very prone to negative emotion, and someone keeps saying, oh, you're victimized and you should be safe, the logical conclusion is that everyone else should adjust to your hypersensitive temperament. Now, that would be fine, but the problem is if you protect people, they get worse, not better. One of the fundamental axioms of clinical treatment for anxiety disorders is that voluntary exposure to what you fear and are disgusted by is curative. So building walls of protection around people is counterproductive.
Yeah, it seems like people need to be building resilience, and they need to be doing that by exposure to fire, you know, any number of things that will cause them pain but give them scar tissue.
Yeah, well, it's voluntary exposure is the trick. Well, and then there's the political dimension, which is, well, the postmodern neo-Marxists, let's say, can utilize these students as weapons in their war, and they do that. That's another element that's very cult-like, because cult organizations tend to find damaged people and use them as pawns. And God, there's just no shortage of that happening on university campuses. It's like the students are the avatars of the faculty possession. You know, so the faculty is ideologically possessed, and then they produce these little puppets who are psychologically damaged to go out and take the flack for the ideology. It's appalling.
Would you say that your courses and lectures produce more resilient students?
I'd have to say that would be my opinion. But over the 30 years that I've been teaching, I've received comments, written comments at the end of courses from, well, be thousands of students, I guess. And the overwhelming majority of those say the same thing, which is that the courses changed their lives and made them stronger. That was the case in Boston when I taught there, and it's been the case at the University of Toronto on a year-over-year basis.
And how would you say you do that? How do you accomplish that increase in resilience?
Well, part of it is I regard my courses, at least in part, as an inoculation against indoctrination. And, you know, you might say, well, how do I know that I'm not indoctrinating my students myself? And that's a very hard question. But what I try to do is to provide my students with an overview of ideological thinking. And that overview is basically predicated on my analysis of mythological stories. And the mythological universe, I think, is a balanced universe, like the Freudian universe is actually a balanced universe. So I'll talk about Freud first, and then we can switch to the mythological idea. So for Freud, human beings basically had three levels of being. There was a superego, and you could think about that as society or as the internalization of society. But Freud knew that there was a positive superego and a negative superego. So the positive superego kept you in line and made you acceptable socially, and the negative superego criticized you to death and oppressed you. So it's balanced. It's like it's got a good side and a bad side. And then there was the ego, that would be you, and it had a good side and a bad side too. And then there was the id, which was like nature. So the superego was culture and the id was nature, and there was you, the individual, sort of crushed between those titanic forces. That's the Freudian view. And the id also had a positive and a negative element. So the negative element would be untrammeled sexuality and aggression, roughly speaking. And the positive element would be, well, all the energy that comes from biological, dynamic biological motivation. So Freud's theory is a modernized update of a mythological representation, because in classic narrative, you have six sets of characters, roughly speaking. There's a seventh that I'll describe briefly later, but there's six. There's nature, it's usually female in its representation. And it's blood and destruction on one hand. So that's the terrible face of Mother Nature and the fact that everything eats everything else to survive. And it's positive on the other, because you're a child of nature, and nature, although hell-bent on destroying you, is also a predicate of your existence. So you've got this terrible dichotomy. And then there's you. You're the individual. Well, there's a heroic element to the individual that makes people noble and mysterious and respectable and productive and kind and good. And then there's an adversarial element, which is satanic in its intensity, torturous, destructive, revengeful, ungrateful, deceitful, all of that. And that's a war. That's the bad guy and the good guy in a movie. And then there's the society, and that's the wise king and the tyrant. And the wise king is the fact that we all share the same language and that we're sitting here in our little warm houses having this nice discussion. And the tyrant is the fact that that system can turn on you at any moment and tear you to shreds. And so that's the mythological universe. There's nature, positive and negative. And on top of that, there's culture, protects you from nature, but also has its own terrible element. And then there's you. And it's so like it's you standing on an island in an ocean, or it's two of you locked in combat on an island that's half tyranny and half order in an ocean that's full of things that you need and sharks. Right, that's the world, and that's the mythological world. And so I can give you a concrete example of an ideological representation of that, and that would be the environmental myth. So environmentalists say Mother Nature is wonderful and beautiful, culture is rapacious and destructive, and human beings are cruel and destructive. It's like it's absolutely true. Human beings are cruel and destructive. Culture is rapacious and, well, rapacious will do. And nature is beautiful, but it's only half the story, because nature is doing her best to kill you constantly. Culture protects you from freezing and starving, and human beings are just struggling to survive, as well as being, you know, throwing plastic everywhere and being messy. And so that's actually the frontier myth versus the environmentalist myth, because the frontier myth was nature as untamed wild frontier, the pioneer as bearer of culture into the wilderness, and the heroic individual. And if you put that together with the environmentalist story, because they match, they're exactly opposite. They make a comprehensive story. And what ideologies do is tell half the story. So the ideologies carry the power of the mythological understructure. And that's why they can possess people. They're fragments of religious belief is really, that's a good way of thinking about them. And unless you know the other half of the story, you can't withstand them. And so what I do is I teach my students the whole story. It's like, yes, you can complain about culture. And we use the university as an example. You're just a number at the University of Toronto. There's 60,000 of you. You can drown in the anonymity, and the university doesn't care about you. You're a number. But on the other hand, God, how privileged do you want to be? You have an identity that's respectable. You're a student. You have more free time than you're ever going to have in your life. You've got money at least enough to survive. You're in this rich culture, you know, have some gratitude for your tyrant. Right. Well, that's the thing. And that's the thing about the bloody SJWs is they have no gratitude. And it's partly because they're resentful. And that's not limited to the left. I mean, you see resentment as the political process polarizes, you see resentment build more and more on each side. And it's a terrible thing. Resentment is unbelievably dangerous. And so I also try to teach my students some gratitude and some respect for themselves. It's like, yeah, you're a horrible, rapacious monster. And at a moment, you could be a Nazi. But that doesn't mean that's all there is to you. And it doesn't mean that that's all there is to other people. So the other thing I teach students is that you're a lot worse than you think, way worse than you think. And you should have some respect for yourself because of that. If you know you're a monster, that makes you a whole different category of person. As soon as you know that, if you have any sense, you're going to be a lot more careful.
So I've got two questions here. How has Jung influenced your conceptions of duality, and how has religion informed that?
Well, we'll start with Jung. I really like the psychoanalysts because the psychoanalysts, I mean, they established a lot of interesting things, but one of the most interesting is the conception of the human being as a disintegrated collection of subpersonalities. And I really like that. I think it's biologically accurate because if you are an aggregation of a set of very fundamental motivational systems, we know the systems. There's a seeking system for exploration. That's the system that drugs like cocaine affects. There's a play system. There's a defensive aggression system. There's a predatory aggression system. There's a hunger system. There's a thirst system. There's a sexual system. There's a temperature regulation system. And there's an affiliation system. And each of those systems, you could think about them as cognitive modules, but that's wrong. They're personalities. They're sub-personalities. And you know that. Think about the last time you got angry with someone. You get possessed by it, and it's unidimensional. It wants to destroy. It wants you to be right, and it wants to destroy. And you'll say all sorts of things when you're angry that you might regret 15 minutes later. And so it's like this underlying system, which is actually grounded in your hypothalamus, a very ancient, powerful, powerful brain area. It leaps up, alters your perceptions, changes the structure within which you experience emotions, directs your attention, has access to your cognitive content, formulates your words. And in some sense, what you do is you jump from being inhabited by one of these systems to being inhabited by another. Now, it's more complicated than that because those systems also get integrated across time. And Freud would have described that as ego development. But I like the description that Jean Piaget, who was the world's foremost developmental psychologist, I like his formulation better because Freud basically said the superego forces you to inhibit the manifestation of these subpersonalities. But I think that's only true if you grew up in a pathological family. If you grew up in a family that was functioning properly, what happens is that you integrate all those subpersonalities into a higher order game. So, for example, you don't want your child to inhibit their aggression. You want them to make their aggression sophisticated. So, for example, when they go out and play hockey or soccer or whatever, or chess, who cares? That aggression is part of the drive to win, to master and win. And that actually makes them better, not worse. So like a sophisticated kid has got all those subpersonalities integrated into a higher order game. That's their identity. But even more importantly, they're doing that in parallel with learning how to play games with other people. So what you do is you're a mess of subpersonalities and I'm a mess of subpersonalities. And so we have to integrate those into a structure that allows for the gratification of all those systems today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, so across time, in a space that's occupied by a whole bunch of other creatures that are doing the same thing. And so what happens is that gets all woven together to a higher and higher order game. It's that game that religious belief systems try to represent and tell you how to play. So here's an example. I'll tell you a story. So one day I was out watching my son play hockey when he was a kid, and it was their final. And he was only about 10 or 11. And they played just down the street. And it's a good league. It was a no-contact league. And the kids were randomly distributed into teams. And then they'd let the teams play a bit. And if one team was really dominating, then they'd re-scatter the kids so that, you know, the competition levels were pretty equal. So that was good. So anyways, it's the final. And my son's a pretty good hockey player, but there was one kid on his team that was better player, but he was a real diva. You know, he wouldn't pass. When he got the puck, it was all about him. It was all about him. But he was a good player. They were winning like 3-2 or something. And then in the last 2 minutes, the other team scored 2 goals. It was a really good game, though. It was really fun to watch. And the teams played well. And then the star kid came stomping off the ice and he whacked his stick down on the ground. And his father came over to him and said, "Oh, yeah, you got robbed. It was really unfair. The reffing was unfair. It was bad. You guys should have won." And I thought, I was watching this guy who I kind of knew. And I thought, you are such an idiot that it is almost incomprehensible. That it's almost incomprehensible you could be that stupid. You just went and saw a good hockey game. Your son played well, except that he was a diva and wouldn't pass and all of that. And then despite the fact that it was a good game and he gets all narcissistic about it and has a little fit, and you tell him that that's perfectly justified. It's like, what kind of moron are you? And I already had some idea at that point what kind of moron he was. But so then you think about that. All right. When your kid is playing a game, you say to him or her, it isn't whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. And the kid has no idea what you mean because you don't know what you mean. But you mean something like, well, don't be a pain in the neck. Don't be a diva. Don't be narcissistic. It's something like that. But you actually mean something really important. What you mean is life isn't a game. It's a set of games. It's a very large set of games. And one way of conducting yourself is to win the current game at all costs. Another way of conducting yourself is to play the current game in a way that makes it much more likely that people will ask you to play more games in the future. And the rule is never win the current game at the cost of being invited to play future games. Right. So then you think there's the game and then there's the set of all possible games. What you want to do is win the set of all possible games. That's the mythological hero. The mythological hero is the person who wins the set of all possible games.
That's almost making a logical case for people who don't experience or exercise empathy to start learning how to experience and show empathy.
That's a good observation. Empathy is probably not the right word, you see, because empathy actually has, I would say, a technical definition, and empathy is associated with that trait agreeableness. And empathy has lots of problems because what empathy does is make you preferentially value kin, and that's fine, but it doesn't work in the broader world. That's why you need conscientiousness, for example, because conscientiousness is kind of a cold virtue. It means I'm going to treat you and you only as a consequence of your productivity and utility. Your emotional tie to me is irrelevant. It's cold. But if you're trying to run something larger than a family, empathy is the wrong moral dimension.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's important that people get this right, because one of the things that you're always called out on by social justice types is, well, you should have more empathy. It's like when a mother grizzly bear eats you because you got in the way of her cubs, that's empathy. And so what you're thinking about in terms of empathy is a higher order virtue that consists of the integration of multiple virtues. And it produces this meta game attitude. So like I might say, well, for example, if I'm having a conversation with someone, I might say, well, I want to win. I want to make my point. I want to enforce my value structure because that's what a point is. I want to convince you that I'm right. It's like, okay, I win the game. But let's say I want to play a meta game with you. It's like, no, what I'm going to do is listen to you in case you know something that will enable me to behave better in the future. And I'll win. And you'll win with a conversation like that, because we're trying to make each other into metagame victors. And that's what a meaningful conversation does. In a meaningful conversation, you treat each person as if they're a player of the metagame. And so each person is exchanging information so that they expand, that their capability expands, and so that they're more productive and more acceptable to people simultaneously.
So where's the cutoff point with the utility of empathy? Is it just at the immediate family level?
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
I think it's a within family. It's a within family ethic. Well, kind. To be kind to someone means to treat them like kin. It's the same word. If you're speaking with someone individually, like you can certainly develop a kin-like relationship with individuals, but you can't develop a kin-like relationship with the crowd. And it, not only that, it's wrong. It isn't the right ethic. The ethic that's necessary to maintain social structures is way more sophisticated than mere empathy. Here's an example. Here's a decision you might make. So let's say that there's 100 kids and they're all deathly ill and they're waiting for a rare surgery. And so some of them are going to die while they wait because there just aren't enough people to undertake the surgery. So there's a waiting list, and it's horrible because the farther down you are on the waiting list, the higher the probability that you're going to die. So I tell you this and I ask you if now people got onto the waiting list merely as a consequence of when their disease emerged. So the ones who've had it longest are at the front of the line. Now, if I pick a child from that group and I tell you a long story about them so that you start to empathize with them as individuals, and then I ask you if they should be moved up the waiting list, you'll say yes. Right, but they shouldn't be moved up the waiting list. Now, what happens is that because you know their individual story, they emerge for you from the background of strangers as something akin to kin. And then your emotions will get activated and you'll say, oh, well, this poor child has this terrible situation. I'd do anything I could to help her. It's like, yeah, you bump her up the waiting list. You need a cold virtue to respond properly in a situation like that. And it's harsh, man. Your empathy is just going to get in the way. It also happens in companies, you know. So here's a funny story. I have a friend who is one of the most disagreeable people on one dimension that you'd ever meet. He's actually fairly compassionate, but he's very low in politeness, which is part of this agreeableness dimension. He's like the most ornery guy. He was often sent into corporations to sort of clean them up when they'd become stupid and corrupt. And part of that involved firing people. Now, I've had to let a few students go. I'm very bad at that because I don't like to hurt people's feelings. And I would consider that in some sense a characterological weakness, by the way, instead of something to be proud of. But anyways, I said, well, how can you stand firing people? He said, I enjoy it. And I thought, oh, well, I've never heard anyone say that. So, okay. I said, why? He said, most of these people, they bloody well deserve it. They're in a group. They're not pulling their weight. They're pulling down the performance of the entire group. They're whining about why they can't do their work. They take way too many sick days. They take advantage of other people constantly. I'm in there to fix that up. It's like, you're not pulling your weight. You're dragging down these other people who are working hard and being straightforward. It's like, out of here. You go find something else to do because you've got things to learn. And I thought, oh, well, yeah, that's right. Well, you can say, well, he took it to an extreme, and that's certainly possible. I mean, he's certainly got into trouble for being disagreeable, but that's absolutely necessary because lots of times productivity, well, and also the willingness to cooperate and compete properly with your team, that's the standard by which you should be judged, right? And the social justice warriors are always saying things like, well, don't be judgmental. It's like wrong. Be judgmental. Separate the wheat from the chaff. It's important to be judgmental. Now, arbitrarily judgmental, that's a whole different issue.
Yeah, it's almost like people have got the definition of psychopath wrong as like lacking empathy.
Oh, definitely. Okay, so let's take this agreeableness trait again. So here's a way of conceptualizing it. You're in a negotiation with someone, and they're going to care about themselves, and they're going to care about you. The more agreeable they are, the more they're going to care about you. And the less agreeable they are, the more they're going to care about themselves. Now, two disagreeable people will face each other and say, you're out for yourself, I'm out for myself. We'll butt heads till we come up with an agreement. But we know where we bloody well both stand. Whereas two agreeable people are going to be trying to make each other happy. Now, you might say that's good, except an agreeable person almost always walks away from a negotiation feeling that they got screwed. And they did. And it's because they don't know how to stand up for themselves. If you're in a family, you have kids, you want everybody's outcome to be good. If you're a parent, you want to be self-sacrificing. Not too much, but a fair bit, especially if it's infants, right? Because they're always right and you're always wrong. A six-month-old is always right. You have to take care of them. If they have a problem, it's your problem. But to operate like that in a world of adults just means that you're constantly being taken advantage of. Because that isn't how adults work, and that isn't how they should work. And so what happens to agreeable people is they get resentful. They say, well, people, like, I'm always doing things for other people, and I don't get any reciprocity. It's like, yeah, well, toughen up a bit. Quit sacrificing yourself so much. Put out some demands. One of the reasons that women get paid less than men is because they're more agreeable. Well, you go to your boss. You say, I need some money. And your boss says, yeah, well, get in line, man. Everybody needs some money. Or if you're agreeable, you don't even go to your boss in the first place. You think, oh, well, if I just keep working hard, they'll probably notice. It's like, no, they won't. That isn't how it works. Money is a finite resource. People fight for it. So how do you fight for money? That's easy. You think, okay, what do I have for options? Can I leave this job? So then you start looking for another job. You think, well, I can't leave because everybody depends on me. It's like, no, wrong. That's the wrong attitude. The right attitude is, I'm valuable, I could go somewhere else, and I'm useful here. So you go to your boss and you say, look, I need some more money, and this is what's going to happen if I don't get it. And your boss says, oh, well, we can't have that happen. Here's some more money. If he's not going to come to your office and say, well, like, here's $1,000 a month raise. That's not going to happen. You have to fight for it. And agreeable people don't fight because they're conflict averse. And you might say, well, it's paradoxical to call the social justice warriors conflict averse. But this is why it's so tricky. A mother isn't conflict averse if she's fighting for her children. She's anything but conflict averse. And agreeable people can fight on the behalf of other people. If they consider them victimized infants, they'll fight like mad for them. And they'll think you're a snake slithering through the grass that's going to eat their child. That's what you are. And they even use the same circuitry to categorize you. I can give you a classic mythological example. So there's endless representations of Mary, Mother of Christ, holding her infant up in the air with her foot on a, like often a snake or sometimes a lizard, a predatory lizard. It's like, okay, forget Christianity. You're a biologist. Look at that picture. What does it say? It says that the good mother protects her infants from reptilian predators. It's like, yeah, we've been doing that for 60 million years. That's a deep category. That's the snake in the Garden of Eden. And the snake is also Satan. And that's a mythological idea. It's unbelievably brilliant idea. That's why we still know the story. So the idea is that people live in bounded worlds. That's the Garden of Eden. Okay, paradise means walled garden, and Eden means well-watered place. So that's a human environment. A human environment is a garden. What's a garden? Half culture, half nature, productively engaged. What's in a garden? Trees and food and snakes. Why? Well, there always is a snake in the garden. Now, why? Well, first of all, because they were one of our predators forever. But more importantly, because no matter how safe a space you make, something will sneak into it. And it'll make you self-conscious, that thing. It'll make you both conscious and self-conscious. Because when a threat emerges, that's what happens. And so then you think, okay, so that's the snake. The snake wakes people up. That's for sure. It's still a snake. Well, what's the worst snake? You could think, well, there's a snake. That's bad. There's a whole nest of snakes. That's even worse. What about the snakes in other people? Oh, yeah, those are pretty bad, man. Those are worse snakes. What about the snake in yourself? Uh-oh, that's the worst one. See, no one knows this. Over thousands of years, this idea emerged that the snake in the garden was Satan. It's like, what the hell? What does that mean? Well, that's what it means. Christ, it's brilliant. It's unbelievably brilliant. And no one knows that we even discovered it. These are deep ideas, these old ideas. They're so deep, they'll just blow you into pieces when you encounter them. That's Carl Jung, man. Read Carl Jung. If you want to be terrified right to the depths of your soul, read Jung. Man, he's the one scary dude. You know, he's often being accused of starting a cult. It's like what people accuse Jung of doing is so much less horrible than what he actually did, that it's like accusing a serial killer of jaywalking.
So what was he actually doing?
He was trying to answer Nietzsche's question. Nietzsche's question was, when God dies, what should we do? Because Nietzsche said, well, God has died. And what he meant by that was the entire value structure of Western civilization was going to fall apart. He knew that. He wasn't celebrating when he announced the death of God. He said, when he announced the death of God, he said, we'll never find enough water to wash away the blood. He knew what was going to come. He said, look, here's what's going to happen. In the next two centuries, we'll fight a terrible battle between nihilism and totalitarianism because those are the alternatives that await. He knew that. Dostoevsky knew that. They prophesied that very, very clearly. And so Nietzsche said, well, how are we going to get out of this? He said, well, we're going to have to invent new values. And Jung came along, studied Nietzsche intensely and said, we can't invent values because you can't invent them. You don't have that control. Mike, you decide on New Year's Day that you're going to go to the gym every week. It's like, do you? No. Why? Because you can't control yourself. You can't just tell yourself what to do. And so Jung did an exploration of the imagination, I would say, dreams in part, myths in part, and said, no, no, we have to haul up our values once again from the depths and find out what they are, make them conscious instead of implicit. The value structure in a symbolic system like Christianity is mostly implicit. You know, what does it mean that there's a redeemer? One of the things Jung said, and this is sort of what Nietzsche pointed out too, is that we lived inside this rich symbolic system. And then one day we woke up and saw, oh, this is symbolic. We have no idea what it means. No, it can't be right. Huh. No, it isn't that it wasn't right. It's just that we didn't know what it meant. What does Mary, the Virgin Mother of God, mean? Well, is it a scientific idea? It's not. It's that the mother is sacred and always gives birth to the hero if she's treated properly. And the hero is the child that can redeem the world. Well, that's every child. It's no wonder an infant is special to the mother. That child is the world-redeeming hero. That's true. It's not the whole story, but it's true. And societies that don't value that, don't hold that as sacred, they disappear. And that's what's happening in the West. We're way below replacement in terms of our birth rate. Mm-hmm. So that's because the mother and child isn't sacred.
Hey, so I think we're going to wrap up the episode there. That was a pretty interesting first half of the episode with Jordan B. Peterson. If you want to check back with the second half of the episode, it should be published in the community sometime within the next week. We're a little bit slow on this because we're still kind of working out what our process is going to be. Also, don't forget to check out Eternity, our sponsor. Their big crowd sale is happening today. So if you want to get in on that, now's the time.
To get all the show notes, links, mentions, books that we talked about in this interview, go to futurethinkers.org/38. If you like this episode, don't forget to share it with your friends, subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher or YouTube or wherever you're listening, and we'll talk to you in the next one. Bye!
Thanks for listening to the Future Thinkers podcast. To get notified of new podcasts and videos, go to futurethinkers.org and subscribe to our mailing list. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, give us a like or a review, share it with your friends, and consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/futurethinkers. If you're looking to get serious about meditation, check out the meditation app that we've created with Vinay Gupta called The Cutting Machinery. Go to cuttingmachinery.org/app.
Last but not least, if you want to get access to more content, hidden episodes, or if you just want to chat with us and previous guests, then check out our community at community.futurethinkers.org.